We're going to pick up where we left off last week, talking about Higgs decays. We computed Higgs to glue glue in a lot of detail. We computed the one loop diagram. We computed the partial width. But now I just want to show you a nice useful trick, which you can file away in your toolbox for computing these kinds of amplitudes more easily. But it only works in a particular limit. So here, we can use this trick. To compute Higgs to glue glue in the limit that MT is infinitely heavy. This seems to work fairly well numerically, even though the mass of the top is comparable to the mass of the Higgs. But so here you go. And so here's the idea. You start out by computing the contribution to I don't think we need this. Maybe they're trying to tell me something. OK. The idea is we start out by just computing the top contribution to the QCD beta function. The only contribution you need to worry about is the contribution of the top to the gluon propagator. So let me just write down the gluon propagator. I'll call this matrix element M. And here's the gluon propagator. We have a top loop here. And these are gluons with, let's say, momentum Q going in and going out. And I'll just write down some indices. We have A and mu, the color of the gluon and the Lorentz index mu, and then the color of the outgoing gluon and the Lorentz index nu. This matrix element here contributes to the gluon field strength renormalization, which of course contributes to the beta function. I think you guys worked it out in detail for QED. It's exactly the same kind of calculation. Let me just write down the matrix element if you wanted to compute it. So we're going to use dimreg. And d is equal to 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions. And the matrix element ends up being I. Is so we have an integral over the loop momentum k. So here's some loop momentum k. Call this k and q plus k. We have a minus 1 for the trace over the closed fermion loop. We have a trace. We have I k slash plus q slash plus mt over k minus plus q squared minus mt squared. We have an IGS gamma mu TA, and then a mu to the epsilon. We have an I k slash plus mt over k squared minus mt squared. And then there's a minus IGS gamma nu TB mu epsilon. And then all that is taking the trace of that. So here's what you get just writing down using the Feynman rules. Remember, these factors of mu to the epsilon comes about because in dimensional regularization, when we're not in four dimensions, the dimension of the gauge coupling is no longer dimensionless. And so we need to factor in the dimension mu here, which is the renormalization scale. All right. So I'll skip the calculation because it's very similar to what you did in QED. It's exactly the same one loop diagram. It's just you have some extra color factors to worry about, which is not so complicated. So I'll just write down the result that you get. This matrix element, after you do the whole procedure of, you know, expanding and Feynman parameters, doing the momentum integral, canceling things out, you get I alpha s over 4 pi. You get the trace of TA, TB, the SU3 generators. You get this factor of Q mu, Q nu, minus Q squared, eta mu nu. And then you have an integral over Feynman parameters. So you have dx, 8x, 1 minus x. And then all of that is multiplying 1 minus epsilon minus the Euler gamma constant plus log of 4 pi plus the log of mu squared all over mt squared minus q squared x 1 minus x. OK, so here's the result at the end of the day. If you want to go through this again, you can. It's in my notes, so you can follow along. But I'll just skip all these steps. OK. Polarization factor. So I haven't put those in. But if I wanted to have like a physical amplitude, I would multiply by like epsilon mu, epsilon nu. And so I've factored that out. So you would just multiply that by this amplitude. So it's divergent, right? As epsilon goes to 0, it's divergent. And so what you want to do is remove the divergence by adding in a counter term. So you add in a counter term, which is, here's the counter term, minus delta 3 times 1 half trace of g mu nu, gluon field strength tensors, and then you take the trace over the SU3 indices. And the counter term that you need to cancel everything out is as follows. So you'd want minus 1 half alpha s over 4 pi, and then this integral dx 8x 1 minus x times 1 minus 1 over epsilon Euler gamma plus log of 4 pi. So this prescription is called MS bar. There's a prescription called minimal subtraction, which is just MS. You include the counter terms that you need to cancel off just the divergent part, 1 over epsilon. MS bar is just a variation of that, where we include the counter term to cancel off the 1 over epsilon minus the Euler constant plus log of 4 pi. So it's just a slightly different prescription. OK, and so now, of course, this is independent of x. And so you can do the x integral, and you get minus alpha s over 6 pi, 1 over epsilon minus Euler gamma constant, and then log of 4 pi. So that's the counter term we need. Yeah, so the motivation is that you always get like the same combination of three terms with every divergence. And so MS bars are simpler because you can just get rid of all the extra constants that are appearing, which don't matter anyway. OK. So we need to include this, this extra counter term in the Lagrangian. And you could think of that as we have a bare Lagrangian. Which I would write as, and I'm only writing the gauge kinetic part, since that's the only thing that's important for this argument, trace of g mu nu a bare field, g mu nu. So the meaning of this is that it just includes the normal piece plus the counter term. And so this is just 1 plus delta 3 times the trace of the, the usual gluon field strength, like this. But now you have to shift the gluon fields to make everything canonically normalized. So you want to absorb this constant into the gluon field strength. So that amounts to a shift as follows. So you want to shift g mu a to be 1 minus 1 half delta 3 g mu a. So you can see if you make this shift in here, terms will cancel out to leading order in delta 3, which is what you want. Because you think of delta 3 as a perturbative quantity, even though it's actually infinite. It's perturbative in the coupling constant. So now you have to look at the gluon interaction. Yeah, so to gauge perturbativity, you want to look at what's the dependence in the coupling constants. Even though formally it's actually divergent, you kind of sweep that under the rug and don't worry too much about it and say, well, delta 3 is order alpha s. And so if I have a term which will be delta 3 squared, then I can just neglect that because I'm just working to leading order in alpha s. OK. So now let's look at what happens to the gluon interaction. You have, first, let me start with the bare parameters, GS0, Q bar 0, G slash 0A, and then TA, Q 0. All right. Now I just make this shift to go to from bare fields to the actual fields, and I just get GS0 times 1 minus 1 half delta 3. And the quark fields don't shift because they don't care about any renormalization of the quark fields for this argument. All right. And so this is the coefficient of the gauge interaction. And so I should identify this as what I called GS, the physical coupling, and then mu to the epsilon, since I need to include the dimension of the coupling now. Oops, OK, let's see. So I'll just finish up. So I can write GS, the bare coupling, as the actual coupling mu to the epsilon 1 plus 1 half delta 3. Or I can write the bare alpha s, which is just this squared over 4 pi, is alpha s mu to the 2 epsilon 1 plus delta 3. All right. Now I can compute the beta function. Since I recognize that the bare coupling should be independent of the scale, the dependence of mu of these terms has to cancel the dependence of mu on these terms. So I can compute d alpha s of the bare coupling, d log mu is d alpha s d log mu times 1 plus delta 3 plus 2 epsilon times alpha s 1 plus delta 3. So when I take the derivative of both sides with respect to d by d log mu, this is what I get. And again, the bare coupling should be independent of the renormalization scale. And so I just set that equal to 0. And so now I can solve for the beta function, which is this. So I get the beta function d alpha s by d log mu. This is the beta function for QCD. Just from the top contribution, this ends up being minus 2 epsilon times alpha s 1 plus delta 3 and then in the limit that epsilon goes to 0.
Why there is the 1 plus delta 3? Like why 1 plus delta 3 is not canceled?
1 plus delta 3 is not canceled. Yeah, right. So yeah, it's a good question. So yeah, so I think what you have to do is set epsilon equals to 0 in this first expression, and you'll see that the 1 plus delta 3 won't cancel, because this term will end up being, it'll end up being different powers of alpha s. So let me put in here, you take the limit that epsilon goes to 0, and then we'll just evaluate both of these sides, and you'll see why it won't cancel out. Yeah.
So we neglect the second term here?
Yeah, you neglect the second term here. That's right. Because this will end up being order alpha squared. And so this term will be alpha cubed. And this term will be alpha s times alpha s. And so that will also be alpha s squared. And so this term here will be higher in order than alpha. So you can neglect that. All right, so when I plug this in, the one term will end up vanishing when you take epsilon to 0. And so the only thing that you're left with is minus 2 alpha s, and then the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of delta 3. So now I can just plug in what delta 3 is. It's up here, and I just need the 1 over epsilon term. So it's alpha s over 6 pi. And so the contribution is just with a minus sign. Yep. So it's just alpha s squared over 3 pi. So that's what I get. So this, again, is the contribution to the QCD beta function just from one fermion flavor. And here we go. So now you can wonder, what does this have anything to do with Higgs decays?
Can you please elaborate more about second equal sign? How did you get rid of the minus the epsilon?
Sure. So it's just taking the limit. And so I'll have this first term will just be minus 2 epsilon alpha s. And then I'll have minus 2 epsilon alpha s delta 3. And so this term will vanish as epsilon goes to 0. But this term does not vanish because delta 3 has a term that goes like 1 over epsilon.
I'm missing an epsilon inside the limit.
Yes.
Second.
I'm missing what?
An epsilon. The limit epsilon goes to 0, epsilon times delta 3.
Yes.
In the middle.
Here. Yeah. Thank you. That's right. OK. All right. So now what we want are how this relates to Higgs decays. And I want to direct your attention to the term in the matrix elements where you have the MT dependence. So we know that the Higgs field H couples via a term, or I should say, couples to TT bar via a term that goes like this, MT 1 plus H over V. So if we shift the top mass, by MT goes to MT 1 plus H over V, this will give us the HGG coupling through the top loop. So so what do we have? So the matrix element would be minus I alpha s over 3 pi q mu q nu minus q squared eta mu nu. So what I want is the term that involves log of mt squared so I have a log of mt squared and then I'm doing this shift where I just write in 1 plus h over v and because it's mt squared I have this squared and because the log is on the bottom I need an extra minus sign so let me write plus here and then I'll write plus dot 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 just because that's only one term, and then there's other terms as well, such as the divergent term, which we ended up treating by all of these arguments over here. OK. So this is, we're taking the limit that mt goes to infinity, which is why we're neglecting the q squared part of the log instead of the mt squared part, which we just keep here. OK. So now we can also expand this log here. So we can just use the fact that log of mt squared 1 plus h over v squared is equal to log of mt squared plus log of 1 plus h over v squared, which is log of mt squared plus 2. And then if I just Taylor expand in powers of h over v, the leading term is just 2 times h over v plus higher order terms, h squared over v squared. So I only want to focus on this term, which will tell us how the Higgs field couples to gluons. So, so I have minus I is it plus? Should be a it's a plus over there. Sorry, I messed up the sign. No, I have a plus. Should be a minus here. Sorry. OK. So the matrix element will be alpha s over 3 pi q mu q nu minus q squared eta mu nu trace TA TB And then we have 2 h over v plus dot, dot, dot. So you can imagine, I want to contract this Higgs field into an external Higgs state. And everything left over will give me the coefficient of that interaction. So I can represent that interaction through an effective Higgs glue-glue vertex. Which is alpha s over 6 pi v Higgs field, and then the trace of g mu nu, g mu nu. So this is what you get. So just to recap, the logic is I'm just computing the gluon propagator, and I'm expanding by shifting the Higgs field, shifting the top mass to include the effect of the Higgs field. And so automatically, the coefficient of the Higgs glue-glue coupling is related to the original coefficient of the vacuum polarization diagram. So I could have written this as one half times the beta function for QCD, just the top contribution, divided by alpha s times Higgs field, and then g mu nu, g mu nu. So there we go. Yeah, because the diagram giving rise to this just came from the vacuum polarization diagram. All we did is shift the mass to include the effect of the Higgs field. So automatically, the Higgs glue-glue coupling has exactly the same coefficient as whatever went in when we computed the beta function. So they're automatically related to one another.
So the H is a field operator, right?
Yeah.
So does it make sense to scale MT by, it's not like a numerical factor.
Yeah. Well, you can kind of think of it that way. So you can imagine just treating the Higgs field as just sort of a classical field and ask how does this matrix element change as you change that classical field? And that change has to occur through the top mass, of course. And so it has to scale in this way. And so we could take the matrix element, expand to linear order in that classical field, and we just get this. And now you can just say, okay, I can treat that classical field as a quantum field, perhaps. And so I can just relate the coefficient of the effective operator that I want to the coefficient of the diagram under this argument. Okay. Any more questions on this logic? You can also use the same argument to compute Higgs to 2 photons. So let me just sketch what the answer is. So we can apply the same logic to the Higgs 2 photon coupling. Here we have sort of 2 classes of diagrams. One is where you have the top loop, which is exactly the same as what we computed for QCD, for the glue-glue amplitude, just with slightly different factors due to color and electric charge. And then the other types of diagrams involve the electroweak gauge bosons, which are just a bit more tedious to compute. So here, for example, here's one of them, where instead of a top in the loop, I have a charged W in the loop. And you have to include both of them. And actually, this one ends up being a lot larger than this contribution. But anyway, we're not going to compute these. You can write this as an effective interaction, where you have 1 quarter times the beta function for QED, contribution from the top and the W, divided by alpha times the VEV. Sorry, I forgot the VEV here. Times F mu nu, Higgs field. So it works exactly the same way. You could compute the beta function contribution from the top loop and the W loop. And use that to compute the Higgs to gamma gamma. This doesn't work exactly as well as this case, just because the W is not much lighter than the Higgs. It's not much heavier than the Higgs. It's actually lighter than the Higgs. And so numerically, this approximation only works to like 50% level. So there you go. Oh, let me just write down what these numbers are. Beta E for the top is 8/9, and beta E for the W is -7/2, I think. Okay. All right, so that's it. Now we're going to talk about production. So we talked a lot about how the Higgs decays. Of course, the other very important ingredient is you have to produce it in your collider to see how it decays. And we're really going to focus on the LHC, since that's what's going on now. So we have the LHC, which you probably know, it's a proton-proton collider. And they're in the middle of their third run, and they've been running with center mass energies of first at 7 TeV, then at 8 TeV, and now at 13 TeV. So what we want to know is what's the cross-section. For producing the Higgs. So let's just first talk about it in a little some generality. Let me just list all of the different processes we can have. So here are the processes. The first one is the one that we're going to focus on. It's called gluon fusion, abbreviated as GGF. And basically what happens there is we have two gluons, which come from the proton, that fuse together to produce a Higgs. And this dot here is a top loop, which I've just written as kind of an effective vertex. Okay. The next process you can have is called vector boson fusion. So you have, let's say, two quarks coming in. So let's say you have a U and a D. And then you have like a D going out and a U going out. And then you can have two Ws coming together to produce the Higgs like this. Or we can do the same process with the Z as well. The third process is called vector boson associated production. Which you can write as WH or ZH, how they abbreviate it. And so in that case, you have two quarks coming together. So let's say a U or a D, and then a D or a U. You can produce a vector boson, W plus minus, which is off-shell. And then that will turn into an on-shell W and a Higgs. Or you could do the same thing with the Z as well. So you could also have a Z and then produce a Z. So you're looking for a vector boson, W or Z, in association with the Higgs. The last process is called top associated production. You produce a TT bar pair through, let's say, a process like this. And then one of the Higgs effectively radiates off, one of the top quarks effectively radiates off a Higgs boson. So all of these are very interesting because you're probing different couplings. For example, here you're probing, for these two, you're probing the Higgs couplings to vector bosons. Here, you're probing directly the Higgs coupling to the top because you're seeing the TT bar in the final state. Here, you're probing indirectly the coupling to the top, but you don't see the TT bar, of course, because it's just virtual top. And so you don't know if perhaps there could be other particles in the loop which might also be contributing to this process. So these two things, these different production mechanisms are all very complementary. I've also listed them in order of importance. So number one, which is the one we'll focus on, is the largest, and then it goes down from there. So let's compute the cross section. And it's going to work exactly the same as what we did for deep inelastic scattering. First, we compute the parton level cross section. And then we have to integrate over the parton distribution functions, the PDFs. So let's start using the parton cross section, which is GG to H. So let's just write down what that is. So I have a 1 over 2 E1 to E2. V rel, integrating over the final momentum of the Higgs. Momentum conservation. And then we have a sum over the matrix elements. And we have to average over, we have to sum over spins and colors. The only things with spin and color are in the initial states, so we have to average over those. Each gluon has 2 spins and 8 colors, so we have to divide by 1 over 8 times 2 squared. Okay, so there we go. Let's work in the center mass frame. So the relative velocity is just equal to 1, equal to 2. I can also make the following assignments. So I know that 4 times E1, E2 is just the center of mass energy squared. And I know that the energy of the Higgs, since it's in the center of mass frame, is at rest, is just equal to mh. So I just want to draw the diagram. You have P1 going in and P2 going in. And you produce a Higgs with momentum Q. OK. So now we can do the momentum integral here using 3 of the delta functions. And we have a pi over 16 squared s hat mh times delta. We still have one delta function left over, mh minus e1 minus e2. And then we have a 1, so we have the 1 over 16, and then we just have the sum over matrix elements squared. Sorry. Okay. Now what we can do is we can relate this matrix element for glue-glue going to Higgs to the matrix element for Higgs going to glue-glue. They have to be the same. They're just related by time reversal symmetry. So I can write this as sum over Higgs to glue-glue, like this. The only difference is I need to include an extra factor of 2 when I do this. The reason is that when I'm computing this process, the gluons are identical because I'm integrating over all possible momenta, right? And so there's a degeneracy where the momentum of one is exactly the same as the momentum of the other when you flip them. Here, there's no such degeneracy just because you're identifying one gluon as one momentum and the other gluon as the other, and so they're just labeled by their momentum. And so I just need to include an extra factor of 2 here. All right. Then lastly, I can relate this matrix element to the decay rate. Remember, the decay for Higgs to glue-glue was just 1 over 16 pi mh times the sum times the matrix element squared. So I can just substitute this in for here to express the cross-section in terms of the decay rate. All right, so what do we have? End result is that the cross section is equal to pi squared times the decay rate, Higgs to glue-glue, divided by 16 s hat. And then we have the delta function where s hat has to be equal to mh. This is just E1 plus E2, of course. Now, I can also write this as pi squared decay rate over 8 s hat times mh. Wait a second. Yeah, I think that's right. Oh, no, sorry. Oh, wait, I think I made an error in my notes. Let's just figure out what I'm trying to do. So I want to relate this to a delta function, which is s minus mh squared, minus mh squared. And let me just factor this. So I have delta of square root of s hat minus mh times square root of s hat plus mh. Of course, both of these are positive, and they're multiplying this, and they have to be equal to one another. So that's delta of 2 mh, and then square root of this minus mh. And so that's just 1 over 2 mh delta of square root of s hat minus mh. OK, right. So now I can plug this in just as equal to this times 2 mh. And since s hat is just equal to mh squared, this is just equal to pi squared gamma Higgs to glue-glue over 16 mh times delta of S minus MH squared. S hat. All right.
Why not
1 over 8? Yeah, 1 over 8, sorry. Thank you. That's right. All right, so now let's talk about the hadron cross-section. So here's the idea. We have two protons going in. I'll just kind of schematically draw it like this. And the basic idea is they scatter by gluons being emitted from the proton and then fusing together to form the Higgs. So here I'll just kind of draw it like this. Here's the process that we're thinking about. Let me write the momentum of these protons as capital P1 and capital P2. So the cross section to produce the Higgs, we want to think about it in terms of this process. But what we don't want to worry about is what happens to all of the other strongly interacting stuff. You know, it's going to interact. But then it's going to hadronize into something. And of course, I don't want to restrict myself, because then I have to put in something about how it hadronizes, which I don't know how to compute. So what we want to do is compute the cross-section to produce the Higgs plus any other hadronic states we can imagine. And so I'll write that as Higgs plus any hadronic states x. And what we showed is that we can compute this using factorization, where the only thing we need to do is put in the parton level cross-section and then just integrate over the momentum of these individual partons.
Can the hadronic state be necessarily two particle state? And can x be like three particle or four particle hadron?
Yeah, it can be anything. In general, because you're at such high energies at the LHC, you'll get huge numbers of hadrons in the final state. Okay. So P1 and P2 are the momenta of the incoming protons. And then we want to integrate over the momentum of the individual partons, which are little p1 and little p2. And we do this by integrating over the momentum fraction. So I'll write integral over dx1 from 0 to 1 times the gluon pdf, which is fg of x1. And then I have the integral over x2 over the other gluon PDF. And then I just need to include the cross section, sigma hat for GG to H.
Is the intermediate particle W or gluon?
Yeah, these are gluons. So what we're doing is the gluon-gluon fusion process. Yeah, no, we're doing number one. Number one could have exactly the same quark lines as well. I could have drawn those two. But there's lots of gluons just by themselves inside the proton. And so I don't need to put in like extra quarks necessarily, but you could get that as well. OK. So P1 and 2 are the initial proton momenta. And then little P1 and 2 are the initial parton momenta. In this case, the partons are gluons. And they're related to one another because p1, little p1 is just x1 times big p1, and little p2 is just x2 times big p2. Now we can also relate s hat, the parton center of mass energy squared, to s, the hadron level center of mass energy squared. So we have s hat is equal to p1 plus p2 squared, which is just equal to 2 times p1 dot p2, because the gluons are massless. And so this is just 2 times x1, x2 times big p1 dot big p2. And again, if we're working in the limit that where energy is much, much larger than the proton mass, then we can treat the proton as effectively massless. And so this is just x1, x2 times P1 plus P2, which is just X1, X2 times S with no hat. The hadron center of mass energy squared. That's the one that's 8, 7, 8, or 13 TeV squared. All right. So now let's just plug this in, and we'll compute what the cross-section is. So I've got sigma pp goes to hx. This is, I have these integrals, dx1, fg x1, 0 to 1 x2, fg x2. Then I've got the cross section, so pi squared gamma Higgs to glue glue divided by 8mh. And then I have the cross section, which is s hat minus mh. And so I can write that as x1, x2, s minus mh. So now I can use this delta function to do one of these integrals. Let's just do the x2 integral. So let's just define a number tau, which is the Higgs mass squared divided by the center of mass energy squared. So then this delta function, x1, x2, s minus mh squared, is, I can write it as 1 over s, x1, and then delta, sorry, times delta of x2 minus tau over x1. So that's true. And I can plug that in, do the x2 integral, and I can get a result. So this implies that we have to have x2 is equal to tau over x1. But we still have to have x2 in the range between 0 and 1. So everything here still has to satisfy, be in this range here. And so not all of the full range over x2 of x1 will give us x2 in the right range. So it's really just this part that you should focus on. So I have tau over x1 has to be less than 1. X1 can also is also between 0 and 1. But where x1 is less than tau, you would get no contribution because you don't satisfy this condition here. So this implies that x1 has to be greater than tau. So now I have, for this cross-section, bp to hx. It's an integral from tau to 1, dx1, fg of x1, fg of tau over x1. Times pi squared gamma h to glue glue over 8 mh times s. OK. So that's the final result. One important thing to note is that if you can see how closely the Higgs to glue glue rate in decay is related to the production Higgs to glue glue, of course, right? And so if you have any process that it's going to affect the decay of Higgs to glue glue, you're sensitive to that through the production of the Higgs through gluon-gluon fusion, right? OK.
Where is 1 over
x1? Where is what? 1 over x1. Oh, yeah, 1 over x1. Thank you. I think there should be a 1 over x1. Great. Forgot about that. That's right. Thank you. All right. So now I'm going to plug in what the cross section is. One thing that you might worry about is we actually don't know what these gluon PDFs are. You know, I can't write down an analytic expression for them that's accurate. They're obtained by data and fitting to data. So we don't really know what they are. But if you look at the very end of Peskin and Schroeder, they have an ansatz. For what these functions can be parametrized as. And they say fg of x is equal to 8, 1 minus x to the 7th power divided by x. So this is just some analytic expression that they pull out of thin air, which is not so terrible. But in any case, you can just download what these PDFs are, plug them into Mathematica, and you can actually see if it works or not. So that's what I did. And let me just show you what the results are when you do this integral. So at the LHC, at leading order in alpha s, here's what we get. So here's as a function of square root of s. So we have 7 TeV, 8 TeV, and 13 TeV. Here's what I get for the cross section. So this is the Peskin and Schroeder ansatz, and this is like the actual fg of x. So they get, so this would be 5.3 picobarns, 6.8 picobarn, and 15.7 picobarn. And then when I actually do it with the right PDFs, I get 10.5 picobarn, 11.5 picobarn, and 14.8 picobarn. 1 picobarn is 10 to the minus 12 barn. 1 barn is 10 to the minus 24 centimeters squared. So this is 10 to the minus 36 centimeters squared. Picobarn is a pretty common unit for cross sections. So it doesn't do terrible, but factor 2 level, OK. You can make your own decision. If you actually just look up the latest state-of-the-art calculations, including higher order terms in alpha s, so this is not just alpha s corrections, but order alpha s squared corrections. People are really good at this stuff. Here's what you get. So state-of-the-art, it's 15.1 picobarn. 19.3 picobarn, and 43.9 picobarn. So that's what we get. You can see how important higher order corrections are. You normally you would say perturbation tells you that alpha s at very high energies is a small number. It's only like 0.1 or something like that. But because when you go to higher orders in QCD, there are just so many more diagrams, and you also have color factors. And so the corrections from these higher order corrections end up being fairly large, of order factor of 2 or so. So that's what we get. I wanted to make one extra comment about how many Higgs bosons are produced, but I'll just wait until next class to do that. Yeah, you have a question?
Yeah, is there a reason why the very simple ansatz from Piskun intruder seems to be better than the actual gateway?
Oh, is it better? It doesn't look better to me.
Well, especially the 13 TV one is.
Oh yeah, the 13 TV one. These two numbers are the same in my mind.
Yeah, but between the state of the art calculation and the actual experiment value,
the 43.
Like 43 and 14 is horrible.
Yeah, but it's also so 43 and 15 is also horrible to me. So they're all pretty bad, I would say.
No, but the Piskun intruder agrees pretty well with the experiment, whereas the state of the art calculations do not.
It does.
Well,
no, so this is only 15. So bad, right? I don't know if you can read it. This is 15.7 and 43.9. So it doesn't agree that well. It doesn't agree much better than 14.8. Right? These two are only off by less than 10%, right?
Yeah.
But this is off by a factor of 3.
Yeah.
Sure, but you would expect the state of the art calculations to be better than the Piskun intruder, basically.
To be closer.
Sorry. No, what I said was confusing.
Yeah.
These also have the actual PDFs in them. So this is what you should think of as the correct calculations in the standard model. So these have the actual FG of X. It's the same as this, but it's just higher order corrections in alpha S. So to get from here to here, you're just including more diagrams, extra gluon interactions, essentially. And so that's a huge effect. These are the two things that you would compare consistently, because they're the same order in alpha S. They just have different PDFs. One is just a simple, stupid form, and the other is what you can actually just download and plug in. Yeah?
So we started talking about the lecture talking about the Higgs theorem. Low.
Yeah.
So could you just state it? Because I'm not sure I got the main point.
Yeah, the main point is that if you write down an effective coupling for Higgs to glue, the coefficient of that coupling is totally fixed in terms of the contribution of the top to the QCD beta function. So in general, if I integrate out the top quark, I have an effective interaction, which is Higgs, G mu nu, G mu nu, and then the trace. The coefficient of this operator in the Lagrangian is only, you can solve for it just by computing the top contribution to the beta function instead of doing the whole one-loop triangle diagram that we computed. Yeah?
So how does this match up with the experimentally observed value?
Yeah, very well. Unfortunately, I would say. I mean, it's fortunately or unfortunately, depending on what you're interested in. So it's a spectacular triumph for the standard model that it does work fantastically well, that these actual state-of-the-art calculations seem to reproduce the actual Higgs production cross-section at the level of 10% or so. So that's really fantastic. But it would have been nice if it didn't agree, because it tells us some new physics that we could go and look for. If they didn't agree, you would say there has to be some new physics which also carries color. And then we could produce those states copiously at the Large Hadron Collider, and we could detect them directly as well. So that would be a fantastic thing. This is also a fantastic thing too. So that's